I would like to see it afterwards. If there's anybody here who can read or translate, I guess that goes together. Some Yiddish. I would like to see him afterwards. Finally, I must tell you again that if you have any special questions, our office hours are posted in 4123 Humanities, and my own office hours I will give you again Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 10 to 11:30. I'm giving you that again, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, from 10 to 11:30. One more thing. I wonder how many of you would like to have every Friday discussion, as we will have this Friday, or how many of you would like me to lecture now and then on Friday. This has to do with how far we get. So if I can have a kind of show of hands, how many of you would not mind a lecture on Friday, now and then? Not. How many would mind? Well, most of you didn't raise your hand, so will I start again? How many of you would not mind a lecture on Friday, now and then? For the stereotype, and I want to make clear again, because some of you are worried that we aren't modern enough, that what I've given you, of course, is the essential prerequisite for the Holocaust, eventually. That must be clear. I talked about some basic documents to illustrate it, so Walter Scott, ancestors, our acquaintances, but I also made clear that that stereotype was spread through pictures, through dictionaries, such as Comte's dictionary. Obviously, I am only proceeding by example. Instead of Sir Walter Scott, if I wanted to go to Germany, I could have used a collection of German fairy tales, a very famous one, the Knab Wunderhorn, the Boy Born of Plenty, where you have a similar Rebecca Isaac situation, which I talked to you about last time. But some of you pointed out something else at the end of the last lecture, which goes into the essence of what a symbol really is. You said quite rightly that the Negro stereotype in America is one of virility and not of puniness. But symbols and fantasies concerned with symbols have contradictions built in. They are, by their nature, irrational. For otherwise, how do you explain that the puny and ugly Jew presents such a challenge to Gentile virility? That's obviously a contradiction. But these symbols and stereotypes, with their irrational foundations, obviously have such contradictions built in. Another problem was raised by you at the end of the, some of you, the end of the last lecture. What about ideal figures in the classical mode, like Michelangelo's David, which I mentioned in particular? Was he not a Jew? Well, there are two things that must be said. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. During the Nazi times, there were constant incidents when a young blonde boy was called up in front and his measurements were taken and they were Aryan measurements, and then they said, "What's your name?" "My name is Moshe Cohen." That happened all the time. But the problem is, it really doesn't matter, because a symbol is an integrative thing. And therefore, if there are exceptions, this matters not at all. But here in the factor, whether David, Michelangelo's David, was a Jew or not, another thing is involved. A trend, or better, two trends, which I mentioned right here, and which I meant to mention anyhow. For in the secularization which we have talked about. The waning for a while of the Christian anti-Semitism. Something else is involved. The differentiation between biblical and post-biblical Jews. This is involved in all romantic Christianity, as we start out with. Ed Schleiermacher, to quote you the most important romantic clergyman whom we've talked about before, the dialogue between man and God ends with the Old Testament, and what remains is an empty shell. This differentiation between biblical and post-biblical Jews is going to be a very important trend. Let me illustrate it to something going forward. Let me illustrate it to you through the famous sermons of the German cardinal called Faulhaber, gave when the Nazis had been in power a few months in 1933. And these sermons, to be taken wrongly at the time at the defense of Jews, were not really, because they continue that trend. So he says, that I may be perfectly clear and preclude any possible misunderstanding, let me make this distinction. We must distinguish between the people of Israel before and after the death of Christ. After the death of Christ, Israel was dismissed from the service of Revelation. She had not known the time of her visitation. She had repudiated and rejected the Lord's anointed, had driven him out of the city and nailed him to the cross. So there's obviously a distinction, which is one trend, which is important for us to remember, between biblical and post-biblical Jews. But the main distinction, which comes with secularization, is still another one. For this comes with the biblical criticism of the 19th century. The biblical criticism associated, I hope, in some of your minds, with Strauss's Life of Jesus in Germany and with Benon's Life of Jesus in France. And what this biblical criticism of Strauss and Renon did in the 1840s was that it demythologized Christ and Christianity. That is to say, as Renon said, but Strauss too, Christ was really a brilliant man. And it demythologized it. It applied history to it. History, which we've seen reviving in so many other ways in our discussion. The result is that the Old Testament is nothing more than the legends and stories of the Hebrews. To be sure, the New Testament is only the story of a very brilliant man set in history and historical circumstances. There is, therefore, no divinity, a secularization. The result is that the Jews are written out of the scheme of salvation, and that the Old Testament becomes merely folk tales of the Hebrew, but nothing that is important anymore in the scheme of salvation, which is destroyed. That means that even the biblical Jews become simply a desert people with a Bedouin soul, and that remains. In other words, that secularization is very important for the stereotype to have remained constant in history. As I told you, a symbol or a stereotype must be something constant and not fleeting in any way. Therefore, the demythologizing of the Bible took the Jews out of the scheme of salvation and thereby made possible the stereotype back into biblical times. The Jew as a desert person with a Bedouin soul. This has modern consequences. For example, the destruction of the scheme of salvation and the taking out of the Jew of the scheme of salvation is important in the long run. It is the reason why so many Protestant clergymen support El Qatar. Biblically, they couldn't do so. Biblically, they would have to support the restoration of Israel. There is in the Bible no doubt about that. But because from the 1840s on, one part of Protestantism really destroyed the scheme of salvation, really largely Christian salvation as well as Jewish salvation, you can see that in the fact that modern Protestant clergymen climb on any bandwagon by and large, as long as it is fashionable and radical enough. In other words, theology has gone by the board, and that is the long-range consequence of taking the Jews out of the scheme of salvation. The last consequence of this biblical criticism of Strauss and Renan, the long-time consequence of that. But what is important for us is that secularization of prevails, that the stereotype cannot be read backwards in history, that what comes now is history. That means environment, national character, but no longer the divine mission, which should suffuse the whole of the Bible and did the Old as well as the New Testament. That is something you must remember if you think that David was a Jew. David may have been a Jew, but he is no longer a part of the scheme of salvation. Therefore, David can be treated like a modern Jewish stereotype. You have, therefore, a double thrust here. One is to make a distinction of biblical and post-biblical Jews. This is anti-Catholic. This is not Catholic, where theology had a much greater hold than it did in Protestantism. But by and large, Protestantism destroyed the scheme of salvation, really, for the Jews, in many ways also, therefore, for Christ. And in the end, you have the stereotype read back into the past. But together with this comes also a scientific idea. The scientific idea of degeneration, an idea that really comes in the early 1860s, the idea of degeneracy. Now, what do we mean by degeneration? And again, here we come into a difficulty, because you use it specifically, you use it generally, and it was used totally specifically. Degeneration became a central concept of the pre-Freudian psychology. The word was first used by Morell in the 60s, was standardized by Lombroso in the 1860s as well. It was standardized in a famous book by Lombroso called Genius and Folly. January Folly of 1863. Now, what is this theory? And what is the importance of the theory of degeneration? And above all, Lombroso publicized it in 1863, Genius and Folly. It means that body and soul are one, and that the outward, that inward psychological disturbances have outward signs that you can tell through the outward construction of a person, his inward, in this case, psychological disturbances. It means, to be more specific, that body deformation, the deformation of body, also signalizes psychological illnesses. The belief, in other words, that body and psyche are one. That is why Lombroso asked, for example, for the death penalty of habitual criminals. Because if body and psyche are one, there is really no cure for a habitual criminal. Because you cannot restructure him bodily, after all. Perhaps to make it still clearer, I should say, that Lombroso in his work gave precedence to weighing, to measuring over clinical observation. More important to him was measuring, weighing the outward than clinical observation. He believed that the body build, the union of psyche and body in disturbed people was essentially atavistic. That is to say, both the body and the psyche essentially showed signs of retrogression, retrogression into childhood, retrogression, at any rate, marks of a kind of retrogressive ugliness, of which he called atavistic. These ideas of Lombroso were general before Freud. As you may remember, Freud broke with these kind of ideas, with that kind of psychology, which Lombroso was the most famous and celebrated man in psychology before Freud, without any doubt. Underlying this idea is what? It's again an idea of beauty. Everything depends on your measurement, on your body. The idea of simplicity and clarity, the liberal idea. Beauty and normalcy are readily understandable. And the normal is the idea of beauty, which is the consensus. In other words, we end up with Lombroso again, in the normal being defined as what we would call today, I suppose, the all-American boy. That is the normal. For Lombroso's theory, and that is what is important, was a liberal theory. And Lombroso, who himself was a Jew and believed in complete emancipation and assimilation, he wrote on this as well, was a committed liberal, like so many, or most, as I told you before, of the Jews who accepted emancipation and assimilation. And that liberalism made for a standard of normalcy, a standard of normalcy which was in fact middle-class behavior, which was in fact, if you like, ideas of looks, decent, or as Freud would say, clean, because he believed in that too, of course. Clean looks, decent and clean, I don't have to explain. You all know what the all-American boy looks like. Do I see somebody in the class whom I can point? I sound so good, but it would be really very difficult to point at somebody. Yes, you look like an all-American boy. So there's one there. There are a few scattered around. But that is the liberal idea. The liberal idea. Now, what is the importance of this? Degeneration becomes the explanation, the scientific explanation, for all that is out of the usual. Here again, the inward and outward go together in a stereotype. And we find from the 1860s on, the Jew connected with degeneration, even in his liberal concept, connected with degeneration. The science, therefore, comes to the aid of the stereotype here. And this is aggravated toward the end of the century. For remember that the era of the 1880s and 90s, which we call the end of the century, the fond de siècle, the end of the century, tried to repudiate liberal and positivist society. And the young people who tried to repudiate liberal and positivist society transferred the word degeneration to that society. Transferred the word degeneration to that society. So while the liberals used it against people who revolted against liberalism, The people who revolted against liberalism used it also against liberal society. Let me give you a concrete example from 1871, what I mean, and let me use again the anti-Semitic pamphlet here, Drumont, to illustrate it for you. What Drumont said, I still earlier believed society was worth defending. But which institution, which social class is worth defending today? All is degenerate, and it is the Jews that exemplify this degeneration. The best, more recent example of the use of this idea is a very famous book, which I know some of you have read, others haven't, Schelling's Journey to the End of the Night. Schelling's Journey to the End of the Night, where in 1936 he finds such decadence throughout the world, Africa, Asia, the United States, everywhere. Everywhere, he said, the poor have only one right, that is to die, either by hunger in time of peace or violently in time of war. This decadence for a whole generation became unbearable. And the reason against are the Jews. They must be killed before things can be righted. And here Schelling uses an accusation which goes together with decadence, but sort of ties together what I have tried to say up to now. Why are the Jews decadent? Why are they tied in with decadence? Because they are homeless. And the main thing is to give form. Now what does that mean? It may not mean much to you, as I just say, just like this. But liberalism, the idea of beauty, what were they all? They were a search for form in an industrialized mass civilization. Look at the classic idea of beauty, harmony, and symmetry of the stereotype, the ideal type, the Aryan type, the gentle type, the Gentile type. What was it but a search for form in industrial civilization? The liberal use of degeneracy, what is it but a craving for clear form? The degenerate is atavistic. He has childish manners, childish form. He doesn't have a form at all. Therefore, clean cut, clean form. Again, orienting oneself really on the classics. The Jew as the antitype is physically and morally degenerate. That means, of course, lack of ethics on the one hand, as we said, certain looks on the other. But above all, it means that the Jew lacks form, lacks clarity of form. He is the antitype. This makes him the carrier of degeneration. This is what attracted many writers to anti-Semitism. This is the anti-Semitism not only of Schelling, but also of T.S. Eliot and of a great many writers, that the looking for form in a formless society, the Jew came to stand for degeneracy, for anti-form. And that is not unimportant in an industrial and frightening mass society. Thus we must say decadence becomes a serious word of accusation. It takes in all of society again, and the foil becomes the Jewish stereotype once more. Let me summarize then what I have tried to say up to this point about the rise of modern anti-Semitism. In the rise of modern anti-Semitism, then, we have seen the emergence of a largely secular stereotype. We have seen that bolstered by mass politics, that is the symbolism and aesthetic symbolism of mass politics. Beyond that, we have seen it bolstered also by science now, a concept of degeneration, which was bound to associate the Jew with criminality, by the way, because degeneration was so closely associated in this psychology of Lombroso with criminality. So it was bound to associate and did associate the Jew with criminality as well. Where then has Christian anti-Semitism been? Among the conservatives, always, as I told you at the beginning. Among the conservatives with their hierarchical Christian orientation. And yet, it becomes again much more than that. For in 1871, Christian anti-Semitism made a spectacular breakthrough in the West and will serve to link the old and the new. Christian Semitism makes a spectacular breakthrough in the West in 1871. That breakthrough will continue to serve as the link between the old and the new. What is this breakthrough? What is this breakthrough? That breakthrough comes suddenly, unexpected. In 1871, a professor at the Catholic University of Prague, I have to stress this, you'll see why, at the Catholic University of Prague, by the name of August Rolling, published a book with the name of The Talmud Jew, one of the really important books in the city. August Rolling published a book called The Talmud Jew. In this, he took accusations against the Talmud from the 18th century, from a very famous tract by a man called Eisenmenger in the 18th century, of which really Rolling was a copy. He copied Eisenmenger very largely, who at the beginning of the 18th century had made much the same accusation in 1711. The Jewish historian Dubnow calls it the old, long-forgotten accusation. It is quite true that since Eisenmenger in 1711, that accusation had been forgotten. Why? Because of secularization. Because, as I said, the whole process of secularization. Now, Rolling resurrected. What does he resurrect? For it is never to be forgotten again. It becomes very thin. What does he resurrect? He claims that the Talmud asserted that all people of the world belong to Israel. That is to say, the universal world conspiracy, not as finance capitalism, but as part of the basic Jewish religious document, the Talmud, the conspiracy accusation now in religious guise. The Talmud advocates taking usury from Gentiles only and never from Jews, a very old accusation which goes back into the 12th and 13th century. Moreover, the Talmud classes Christians as image worshippers, as worshippers of Baal. And finally, it allows sodomy to be practiced by Jews or non-Jews. It encourages, in fact, sodomy to be practiced or non-Jews. The thrust of it is this, that non-Jews are to be regarded as objects of exploitation. And this was the thrust of this pamphlet called The Talmud Jew. of 1871 by August Rowling. This by a Catholic scholar, a book that has never been disavowed by the Catholic Church. The book had a great impact, especially in Austria and especially in Vienna, where the Galician Jews were immigrating in large numbers. Popular speeches at one workers' gathering, for example. The workers were told, "Do you know what the Talmud says? All Christians are donkeys and swine." And everybody knew what the pig meant to do. So that Jews saying Christians are swine is something of a special dimension, because everybody knew how much Jews hate swine. But all this would not have been considered. There is another accusation in the Talmud, Jew, which is more serious still. And that is the accusation that the Talmud exerts Jews to ritual murder. And about this, I must say something more. Because the rolling accusation of ritual murder coincided with a ritual murder case which was going in Hungary, the case of Tisza Etla, a village in Hungary where ritual murder accusation was made. In other words, Rowling brought the Talmud in connection with ritual murder at the same time that a ritual murder case was making sensation, the case of Tisza Etla. Now, what then is this ritual murder? Why then was there such a special and important matter? Why? Now, first of all, it must be made clear, as I will eventually, that ritual murder accusation has never died out in Eastern Europe. That there is in Eastern Europe, in Russia, no decay which is free of ritual murder accusation. But in the West, it was now unknown, and it had been unknown for 2 centuries. This goes again with the secularization. So that the accusation in the West, together with a case, and a spectacular case, I'll come back to it, a Tisza Etla in Hungary, made it all the more grievous. As far as the Jewish communities were concerned. What then is ritual murder? And again I must say something, for it will never die out again. It will serve to link the old and the new anti-Semitism, and the Talmud Jew book links the old and the new anti-Semitism. I remind you that ritual murder is the accusation that Jews perform human sacrifice. And that the human sacrifice which Jews perform is to slaughter a Christian child and drink its blood. This is basically what ritual murder is, the slaughter of a Christian child in order to drink its blood. The origins of such accusations go back to pagan times, pre-Christian times. And indeed, the accusation of ritual murder was made against the early Christians as well. It was therefore hardly anything new. It goes back to pagan times. It was made to the early Christians. But from the 12th century, it was exclusively directed against the Jews. Now why? Well, there's more to it than the simple skeleton that I have given you. There's more to it than that. Why? The earliest explanation which go with ritual murder and which were persist is that Jews crucify a Christian child in Passion Week before Easter. For many years and centuries, ritual murder by Jews was associated with Passion Week. That is to say, the week of Christ's Passion, before his crucifixion, the crucifixion which takes place on Easter. Now why? Because the Jews do it to mock Christ's crucifixion. In other words, ritual murder was a species of a black mass. It was, in fact, a mockery of Christ's crucifixion at the very time of Passion Week and Easter. This explanation, however, by our period, has given way to another. For ritual murder is now associated with the Jewish festival of Passover. And the accusation is now much more specific, namely that Jews slaughter a Christian child, drink its blood, and mix that blood in the unleavened bread for Passover. How are we to explain this? How are we to explain this? It is explained specifically through the fact of the unleavened bread, through the fact of the special ceremonies of Passover, which were believed to have an anti-Christian direction. But moreover, it is explained still more by the fact, the medieval fact, that Jews were associated with medicine and magic. Now remember that throughout most of the Middle Ages, the Jews were the doctors. And remember also that medicine and magic were very closely linked. The Jewish doctor was familiar, a familiar sight, and magic was associated with medicine. Therefore, it followed that the Jew was associated with a certain kind of magic. That magic being associated with medicine associated the Jew also with blood, and associated him with blood in two ways. First of all, through this connection of magic and medicine, which is obviously an association with blood. But secondly, through a theological thing, namely through the host. For with ritual murder always goes another accusation. These are inseparable. Jews not only slaughter a Christian child, etc., they also take the Christian oath and get it away from its own sacramental involvement. What I mean by that Jews steal the host from the church. Remember, the host is Christ's body and Christ's blood. And remember that after the priest has performed the miracle of turning the bread and wine into Christ's body and Christ's blood, a ceremony closely associated with Passover, closely associated originally with the Jewish Passover, that he puts it in a specially sanctified container. The Jews were said to steal the host so consecrated, to destroy it, but it is also said that the host so destroyed still bleeds. In other words, the host so destroyed performed the miracle of the bleeding host. And in many European churches, you can still see a plaque to this miracle of the bleeding host. But once again, the Jews are associated with blood, they are associated with sacrifice. I would say, just by the way, that such a supposed sanctification of the Holy served as the reason for the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. When the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, the reason was such a bleeding horse, or the miracle of the bleeding horse and the Jews. Now, this accusation of ritual murder had obviously in the West no great force during the Enlightenment. Whatever stereotype the Jew had during the Enlightenment, surely this would be the deepest Christian superstition. In the Russian Empire, everywhere such accusations. In the West, none, for reasons that must be clear. None except now. For Rowling's book has made it clear that the Talmud encouraged ritual murder. And at the same time, right next door, you have the case of Tissa Esra, a typical case. In 1882, a girl disappeared from the village. The Jews were accused. It is always that way. You've all seen the picture, haven't you? Or that I don't have to talk so much about this. Have you all seen the picture? Talk all about ritual murder. Accusation. You haven't. I can't help it. 1882, a girl disappeared. The Jews were accused of having murdered her in order to use her blood to bake unleavened bread. This was a sensation, for this happened in the Austrian Empire, not in backward Russia, not in backward Poland, or former Poland. Everybody knew Russia and Poland were backward. But this happened in the Austrian Empire, for all intents, in the West. The Jew was arrested. There were anti-Jewish riots. And he was acquitted. But the acquittal was not believed. The day of Charles, the name of the man's acquittal, there were some of the most serious anti-Jewish rioting all over the Austrian Empire. It was, of course, never believed. Now, this was the beginning of a whole series of ritual murder cases in Austria and Germany. The most important is the so-called Pilsner case in Austria, important because the Jew was actually convicted of ritual murder. The Pilsner case of 1899, important, as you all know, because who was the defender of Pilsner? Motherick, the man who founded the Czech state eventually. Motherick defended Hilsner. But Hilsner in 1899 was in fact found guilty of ritual murder. He was imprisoned, in fact, until 1918. And when he was acquitted in 1918, there were serious riots against the founder of the Czech state. Motherick was founding Czechoslovakia in 1818-19, and in spite of his great stature as founder of Czechoslovakia, we have serious anti-Semitic riots against Motherick, just as he founded the state, because of the acquittal of Pilsner after 19 years in jail. But that is not all. Germany was not spared. The ritual murder in Xanten in 1903, we are now in the 20th century, the ritual murder of Xanten, the Jew was acquitted, but it was debated in the German Diet for 3 or 4 days. That seriously was it taken. It led to a very large debate in the German Diet. There is one more ritual case in Germany thereafter, before 1914, a case in Collins, where the man was first convicted. Now I'm telling you all this so that you can see two things. Firstly, the importance the very great import of Rowling tying the Talmud not only to anti-Christianity, the Christians are pigs and swine, but also to ritual murder. How Rowling tying up the accusation to ritual murder links with the actual ritual murder accusation, the first in the West for two centuries. Hitler, then Hilton, Johnson, Cronin, all of these now come in a series. What is the importance? The importance is clear. The old anti-Semitism is now linked to the new. The Jew as a symbol and stereotype is once again linked to the ancient medieval accusation of the deconsecration of the host, and not only the deconsecration of the host, but also ritual murder. The climax of this comes during the Nazis, and I mentioned this just by the way, with the 1936 ritual murder number of the paper, the Stürmer, which devoted eventually 1936 a whole number to a ritual murder. It will never, as it were, go down in the West, while in the East it is never, of course, vanish at all. Now, what about the Rowling matter itself? What about the Rowling matter itself? And here we must notice the attitude of the Vienna community. But what was the Vienna community going to do in this kind of accusation? What would you expect it to do? You would expect it what? Yes, that's about right. You would expect it, as he says, join the Point Brigade. But still, what was the Jewish community of Vienna going to do? What was its attitude? This of the Jewish community of Vienna, its reaction, adds another dimension to the Rowling case, adds another dimension to the whole case, a dimension of a dilemma. For here now, in the year of the Lord, 1882, when you believe that good liberals in progress, you were suddenly confronted with accusations that you thought were long dead and buried. You were suddenly confronted with the spread of these accusations, even in working men's clubs, everywhere. What were you to do? This is now a very important matter. And here we must remember the nature of the established Viennese community. A long time ago, when we talked about emancipation, I told you that this community has a special feature: patriotic, loyal to the Habsburgs. A special feature of a German patriotism in the Empire. Well, the Rowling case I will conclude on Monday. Now, if there's anybody who knows Yiddish, I'd very much like to see.